testing. Will everyone be seated, please? You hear? Will everyone be seated, please? In view of the hour, we are most anxious to get started, and I'm going to take the liberty of introducing the head table at this time. I'll ask that you withhold your applause until the entire head table is introduced. Thank you. At my far right, our executive director, Mr. Clarence Judah. Will you please rise upon the announcement of your name, please? Next to Mr. Judah is my good friend, Mr. Morris Kling, Vice President of the Louisville Conference of Jewish Organizations. Mr. Kling. Next to Mr. Kling, is Mrs. Carolyn Neustadt, Chairman of the Women's Division of the United Jewish Appeal. Next is my good friend, Mr. Bernard Berman, Chairman of the Pace Setters. On my left, Mr. Bernard Barnett. And if you will give me one moment, I will attempt to read his accomplishments. He is a chairman, a national chairman of the United Jewish Appeal. He is also on the executive committee of the United Jewish Appeal. And this year, for the second straight year, he is co-chairman of the Louisville United Jewish Appeal, Mr. Bernard Barnett. Next to Mr. Barnett is our honored guest of the evening, who will be formally introduced later, Mr. Hubert Humphrey, former Vice President of the United States. Next is Mrs. Mary Helen Bick, whose accomplishments in the city of Louisville, the state of Kentucky, and this great country of ours are too numerous to mention. Mrs. Bick. Next is Mr. Stanley Yarmouth, a member of the Executive Committee of the United Jewish Appeal, a co-chairman of our local Louisville United Jewish Appeal, and a potential president of Churchill Downs. Try and bear with us and eat your dessert quietly as possible. And I'll ask the waiters, please, not to remove the dishes during our program. It is now my pleasure to introduce Mr. Morris Kling, Vice President of our Louisville Conference of Jewish Organizations. Mr. Kling.
Mr. Chairman, honored guests, ladies and gentlemen, the last time that I had dinner with our esteemed guest here tonight, I think it was October, it cost me $100. We are all happy to know that we're here tonight where it will cost us nothing. I'm here pinch-hitting for Joe Kaplan, president of the conference, and I want to welcome you on behalf of the conference to this meeting. It is really tremendous how Jews in Louisville and Jews all over the United States and Jews all over the world will come to meetings like this year after year after year after year and give of their money and give of their understanding. They must certainly appreciate the need for Israel, and in understanding Israel, they must understand that they're also helping themselves. It is also a tremendous thing that people will work on this campaign. The Barney Barnetts, the Stanley Yarmouths, the Ed Winklers, the Carol Neustadts, the Coles, the Ingrid Ehrlichs, the Presmas, the Rosenbaums, and I could go on and on and on, and who give of their time and effort to do this tremendous job. And on behalf of the conference, I can't thank them.
Too loud?
No.
I know.
Or too long.
on behalf of the conference, I can't thank them because they are a part of the conference, and it would merely be patting yourself on the back. I think we're here tonight to do a job, and as my very good friend Sam Fishman tells me, that when you give something, you always get something in return. And I hope that when you give tonight, you measure it in dollars, because if you give $2,000, you're going to get more in return than if you give $1,000. When I came back from Florida this afternoon, I got a rental car. It was an Avis, and the Avis is second best. And Avis also says that in 4 years, they are going to be first. And I want the honored guest tonight to remember that. We're here for a serious business, and we must maintain a strong Israel, and we must support Israel with every power we can, but to do that we must also have a strong Jewish foundation here locally and nationally. Louisville can be well proud of its many Jewish agencies and the job that they're doing. I suppose for a town the size of Louisville, we have more than any city in the country. The need for additional funds for these agencies is also very important. And I could read off a list that was given me of some of the extra costs that will be involved this year. I'm not going to read through them because I'm sure that all of you are involved with one or more of the agencies, and you know the need, you know the overhead goes up, and you know that the cost of doing business in the local agencies and the need to maintain these agencies is very, very important. Therefore, when you make your pledge, I urge you, as you know, we have a two-line card. I urge you to take in consideration the fact that the local agencies will need $55,000 more this year, and please give an increase also on the first line, which will take care of the local agencies. A good part of that goes to Israel, too. And you will help build a good foundation so that we can do a good job for Israel. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Morris. I think that's one of the reasons you and I have made this a nice team throughout the years. You keep fighting for Louisville, and I keep fighting for Israel. It is now my pleasure to present Mrs. Carolyn Neustadt, Chairman of the Women's Division.
I thank you for that presentation, but in view of the hour and the business at hand, I have nothing to say. But thank you for presenting me.
Thank you. That was great. It is now my pleasure to present a man who definitely needs no introduction, inasmuch as I would say that 99% of the people here can call Barney by his first name. And Barney will introduce Mr. Humphrey.
Say, with such a large crowd tonight that my stentorian voice may not work. I want to say first that Carolyn Newstead has done a magnificent job along with all of the women's division. It is absolutely essential to the campaign. It's not just plus giving, it's giving from the heart, and also the women, after all, control all of the men. Mr. Vice President, I can tell you in 1972, Max Fisher and I'll take a trip, as you once suggested. But as you well know, over the years, many times I've had an opportunity to support you, to know that you have been a close friend of the Jewish community and of all of the minorities in America and the world. As a matter of fact, I would say that you're a great humanitarian. Your politics came later. I could say to these people, a few years back, I had the opportunity to speak in Minneapolis. And my friends there, after the meeting, told me things that were unbelievable for a great city until Hubert Humphrey became the mayor of that city. That the Jewish community there were not even allowed in the AAA Automobile Club. He and many of his friends made a front to open the way. He opened it in Minneapolis, he opened it throughout the United States, and I think the world. We're deeply grateful for your being with us tonight, and I think you know that Herb Friedman, in urging you to accept this invitation, gave recognition to Louisville as one of the outstanding communities in the United States in its performance in supporting the United Jewish Appeal in all charitable and civic activities. We are among the top per capita givers in the United States, and I can say in the free world. I know, as a great student of the Middle East, observer of Israel, you would agree with me that this is one of the most critical times in Israel's short history. You can say in 1967 it was easy for us to go around the country and say to everyone, with great pride and great emotion, about the victory that Israel won in the Six-Day War. It's true that the war ended on the sixth day, but on the seventh day, a new war against Israel started, a 365-day war. I'm sure, hearing your message, knowing exactly where we stand in the survival of Israel and the Jews, that our community, once again, will meet the high levels that it has in the past. It's my great privilege to present to you a great friend of Louisville, Kentucky, and Kentucky, Vice President of the United States, Mr. Hubert.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Burnett, our friend Barney. And there are so many distinguished and honored guests here this evening that I trust you will permit me just to mention the few that have already been introduced to you and to say how very pleased I am to be back in Louisville. I have a few observations that I would like to make preliminary to my informal and formal remarks. I'm looking forward to hearing from Stanley Yarmuth tonight. I know that he's going to do a very good job for us. And I'm very happy to be at this bipartisan meeting presided over by Barney and Mary Helen. As I figure that's very good. And to Mrs. Neustadt, I just want to say this, that I am fully aware of the fact that you've had, that the girls have gotten the jump on the fellows once again, that you had a meeting in January, and that you had one last night. And I'm delighted that they decided to make this meeting co-educational. I've seen you fellows enough alone. This gives it an extra dimension. And when I heard somebody say, "Where's the dessert?" I could only say to myself, "My goodness, can't you see it all around this room?" I can. Well, to Ed Winkler and to Mr. Berman and to Mr. Swing, and to one and all that are here, let me tell you, you're doing a big job, and you've got a big job in your hands. Morris Kling gave a little indication of some of the job that we have ahead of us, and he said something that reminded me of my situation as he looked over at me. He talked about Avis, and he reminded us that when you're number two, you have to try harder. But I want to tell you, when you're number two, it hurts. I knew you'd get it. I knew you'd get it. So let's be number one. And that's what we want to do with Louisville. And to Stan Yarmouth, I want to tell you that whenever you get the feeling that you're a potential president, it's some feeling. I can assure you that. What fun you're going to have. But I have a reason to believe you're a little more potent than I am. You may do all right. And Morris, let me say that while you were referring to that time that we were together, was it in October, at a $100 dinner. That was the United Fund for Humphrey. And this is a different one. This is the United Jewish Campaign, even though there is some similarity, I might add. That was just, that was just tips for what we expect tonight, I want you to know. I'll never be. Some of you may recall what the late John Kennedy said when he addressed a big Democratic gathering and he found out that everybody there had paid $1,000 a plate. And he looked over that wonderful audience of all of these great Democratic givers. And he said, "I'm touched." But he said, "I gather you've been touched first." Now tonight, I come to you in a different capacity than the introduction indicated. I always have great respect for anyone that occupies that awkward office called the Vice President or the Vice Presidency. My heart is filled with compassion and understanding. And I'm pleased that I was introduced as the Vice President of the United States. But I think you ought to know you're only paying for one at a time. And I'm just traveling under false colors, that's all. But it's good to be introduced that way. It makes me feel good. But I'm a very much emancipated human being. And when you're Vice President, you can't always say that. You have other obligations. And tonight I'm going to talk with you a little bit about some of my experiences that relate to your common cause and my common cause. Now, you know what my new work is. It's rather diversified. I'm involved in some business enterprise with the Encyclopedia Britannica, and I'm involved in teaching with a great university and a college, and I'm involved going around the country once in a while and giving a talk and doing a little political work to worry Barney and some of his friends a little bit. But, I really hadn't planned it this way. I want you to know, as much as I enjoy being here. I used to go to these college campuses and talk to the students, and it was in those days, and they're still the days somewhat upon us, when particularly when you represented the Johnson-Humphrey administration, you weren't always the most popular person on the campus. And I'd try to immediately make some good contact with this young group, and I'd start out, saying, "Well, I'm a refugee from a classroom," which was partly true because I used to be a teacher and a professor. And then I'd look around and I'd tell the young folks, I'm a soft grader, too, just in case. That'd get a few people over with you. And then I'd look around and see if I could find the university or college president, whether he was locked in or locked out or wherever he was. And some poor, harassed member of the board of trustees. And I'd say something like this. I'd say, you know, I want you to understand that my professional credentials as a political scientist are in good order. I want to impress this upon you, because elective public office is such an uncertain and precarious existence that I thought I'd just put in my bid for a job just in case things went wrong. And then I'd laugh and chuckle, you know, never realizing how convincing I turned out to be. So here I am, having convinced myself and many, many others. But I'm back to teaching and liking it, and I'm sure going to like it. But I'm also going to do what I like best to do, and that's to visit with the people of this country, and I can tell you in some other countries in the short order, to talk to them about our common destiny and some of the problems that beset us here at home and abroad. Now, you have a great opportunity here in this great city of Louisville. It's a beautiful city, and it's in a wonderful state. And this community represents some of the finest people in our country. I've been told, and of course I do know, that the Jewish community in Louisville is a very generous community. That impresses me. But more importantly, it is a civic-minded community. And that impresses me greatly. There are people in this room tonight that are the leaders in every walk of life in this city and in this state and in this nation. And that's what's really important. I don't worry about your sense of generosity for whatever cause it may be. And the fact of the matter is, all across this great nation, there are hundreds of thousands of people like yourselves that are not only generous to United Jewish Appeal or the Combined Jewish Appeal or the Jewish Federation Program or whatever you wish to call it. And each community has its own name. But you have been generous to colleges, Catholic, Protestant. You've been generous to every community endeavor. And there is a reputation that has grown for the people of Jewish faith in America for incredible generosity. And the interesting thing is that the more generous you are, the more you have, not the less. And this is pretty true of most everybody. The only time this country's ever been in serious trouble is when we thought we could keep it all for ourselves. And that was back in those dark days of the late 20s and early 30s, much too far back for any of the ladies, with few exceptions here tonight. But it is a fact, there was a time that we closed our doors to people who wanted to come in with cruel immigration laws. We closed our credit to those that needed it. We closed off our aid to those that deserved it. And we ended up closing up our banks and losing our businesses and ultimately just closing out millions of our people from participating in the life of this nation. We've learned some lessons from that. I think we have. I hope those lessons of history are literally seared into our memory. And I know they are here. And I repeat to you again that an act of compassion, that an act of generosity is a great investment. It's an investment not only in other people, but in yourself. It's an investment not only in the cause or the needs of others, but of your own. And surely of your country. So I come tonight to speak very openly and very candidly with you about what you are trying to do. I'm here for just one purpose, and that is to get you to do what you intended to do, only to do it in capital letters. Because really, if you were only going to do what you intended to do, we didn't really need the dinner, except for an evening out. And I imagine most of you are out plenty of evenings anyhow. What we ought to do in the moments that we have here is to think about the meaning of what our act or our action will be. Now, I want to just kind of divide it up into easy segments for you that will be somewhat digestible. Your program is divided up into both national into three segments, really: national, local, and international. And that's good citizenship. You can't be a good citizen in this country any longer without having deep concern and involvement. Not just concern, but involvement and commitment at the local level, the national level, and the international level. Those are the three areas where the life of a citizen is to be tested. Now, your program of assistance and aid is involved here with hospitals and schools and training and jobs and family welfare services. Now you say, well, goodness, doesn't the government take care of most of these things? Yes, the government does a lot of things. Some people think it does too much. Some people are very critical of what it does, even if it does enough. Some people think, as I do, that we could do more and ought to do more. But whatever the government may do, let me tell you, the margin of difference between a successful program of social betterment and a failure is citizen involvement. Whenever government does it alone, it has to be computerized, so to speak, rather inhuman, or less than with human personality. It's the voluntary participation that brings out the flavor, that adds that sense of humanity. And even though that voluntary participation may be a small percentage of the total needs of a community, it is that little bit extra that makes it count. It's what brings out the meaning of what we're trying to do as a people. For example, your government today spends hundreds of millions of dollars in job training, trying to help people help themselves. Very important, and without it, I don't know what would happen to us in this nation, as dangerous as the times are. But it's that little extra which the private businessman puts in, which an organization, a non-profit charitable organization, a philanthropic group does, that makes the whole thing seem worthwhile. And that's why, whatever your percentage is, I think somebody said 35-37% or more, whatever the percentage is of your gifts that goes to these philanthropic endeavors, that's what really counts and makes things add up. Now, we've been doing a lot of things, and people wonder why things aren't better. I said I'm on the campus, and people say to me, what's wrong with all these young people? Well, first of all, there isn't much wrong with them. So with some, and they generally reflect pretty much the culture from which they come. If they get a little out of hand, I mean, I say quite candidly that we can all individually and collectively look in the mirror. We cannot disclaim responsibility. But this is a very bright generation that we're dealing with. Maybe sometimes people think too bright. I don't. They're sharp. They're alert. More than that, they are concerned. And many times they're concerned on great big issues that is beyond their immediate control or even comprehension, because they've had so little chance to be really involved as individuals. So when they get to the university and their college, which is their environment, they begin to act their way about problems that they think will be their problems. Now, let me show you why they're concerned. Here you are in a country that has for 35, 40 years been having the constant problem of food surpluses, and we wake up to find out in this late period in our life that hunger is a pattern of life for hundreds of thousands of people, that millions are the victim of malnutrition despite all the advertising, despite all that we've done in food processing. And we have people who say, well, we don't know what to do about it. It is incredible that anybody would even dare say that. I tell my young student friends, I said, look, you're the now generation. You want to do everything now. There are some things you can't do now. You can't make a doctor overnight. You cannot train an architect overnight. You cannot, in 1 year, make an engineer. There are some things you just can't do that quickly. But you can feed people. And in 1 year or less, we can banish hunger from every county, every township, every village, every home in this land. We can do it if we have the commitment, if we have the will. And it won't cost very much either, in terms of our gross national product. We could do it. And maybe in the process of doing it, we'd improve the economy so that the farmer that suffers from poor prices because of surpluses would find out that he was needed, and you'd quit paying him for not working, quit paying him for not producing, and start to pay him for producing. It might do something for everybody's moral stature. So the young man and woman today says, what's going wrong around this country? Here we are, paying out billions of dollars to tell people not to produce, paying out billions of dollars or millions of dollars for storage of what some people said were unneeded food products, and we find all at once that hunger stalks the land. So they're angry, and they haven't had a lot of experience. Wisdom doesn't come instantaneously. They don't even have a lot of information, which without information you have no judgment. But at least they respond. Their instincts are right. Then what else do they see? They see unbelievable wealth. They read about a $1 trillion economy that's on our doorstep next year. Not later than 2 years, and most likely next year. And they say, what's this business? A $1 trillion economy. And yet we've got hundreds of thousands of people in abject poverty. They say, what's wrong with the system? Well, you know that there are many things, I suppose, wrong with it, but I don't happen to think there's enough wrong with it to junk it. Some of them say, let's get rid of it. You and I have to answer it a different way. But we can't say there's nothing wrong. We have to do something about it. Here we are, a country that can put superhighways from one end of this nation to another because we committed ourselves to it. Then they cost millions of dollars a mile. And we're literally within a year or two of being on schedule. In 1949, the late Senator Robert Taft and Allen Ellender of Louisiana, neither one of them radicals, pledged to this country in the Housing Act of 1949 that there would be a decent home for every American family. That was a commitment 20 years ago. They said 20 years ago that we would at least construct 135,000 public housing units per year for 6 years. That's 810,000 units in 6 years. That's 1949. We've constructed less than 500,000 in 20 years. We could have done better. We made a choice between four-lane highways and inadequate housing. We have to get our priorities right. Now here's the same group of young people that say, look, we can have a man up there in Apollo 8 and Apollo 9, and the environment, the air that he breathes, everything that is about him is perfect. There's one thing, he's not going to choke on smog. And the water that he drinks is clean. And even despite the fact that they'll be in orbit for 10 days with all the problems that that presents in terms of personal hygiene and sanitation, they live in an environment that is cleaner than all of the environment in Louisville and all of the environment in Minneapolis put together, and the water's cleaner and the air is better. They say, well, good God, if you can do that, how come you can't protect the Great Lakes so that they're not destroyed? Body of fresh water in the world, God's gift to mankind, and we're destroying it. Why is it that we can't do something about smog? Now, I don't say that there are any easy answers. I'm just telling you why they're concerned. They are concerned and they see the madness of war. They see it on television, too, and they say, well, how come people haven't got enough sense to stop that? And so here we are. Now, have we done nothing about it? Of course we have. We've created institutions like the United Nations and the World Bank and other things in the international field. Diplomats work ceaselessly to try to find some answers to the struggle between nations and people. We are trying to do something about poverty. We're pouring in resources. We see illiteracy, and yet we have a great educational system. We're still pouring in hundreds of millions of dollars into education. We're doing a lot of things, but we need to do more. And I'm here to tell you that you got to do more. And if we don't do more, my fellow Americans, we're the ones that are going to suffer. Make no mistake about it. We have more to lose than anybody else. Now, there's an old story about Winston Churchill that will summarize this part of my little talk for you. When Winston Churchill was at the height of his great responsibility and leadership in Great Britain, a little group came in to see him, headed by a sweet little old lady in tennis shoes, and it was the Temperance Society of Britain. And they demanded an audience right at the time when Churchill was fighting for the life of his country, to talk about his habits of alcoholic consumption. And they finally got this audience, and they said, Mr. Prime Minister, this little old lady said, you know, we've evaluated here and analyzed all your drinking habits, and we've come to the conclusion after careful analysis that if all of the whiskey, the scotch, and the brandy, and the alcoholic beverages that you've consumed since you've been Prime Minister were poured in this room, it'd come up to here. She said, what do you have to say about that? And he looked, he says, up to there? She said, yes. He looked down at the floor. He looked up at the ceiling. He said, so little have I done. So much is there yet to do. That's it, you see? So little have I done. So little have we done. So much is there yet to do, and time runs out on us. Now, a nation's foreign policy, and I can speak with some authority on this, is not a bit better than its domestic policy. You're not going to be able to talk peace in the world when you can't keep peace at home. You're not going to be able to wage war on poverty in the world if you can't wage it successfully here at home. You're not going to be able to train the unemployed, poor peasant and campesino all around the world if you can't do something about your own people back home. Make no mistake about it. We're being tested right here. Right here. So our nation's domestic attitudes conditions what is ultimately going to be its foreign policy. I think one of the great problems in Asia is that we know so little about it. We know so little about it. And that's why we sometimes make mistakes. And that's why we sometimes have so little public understanding of even what we're trying to do if it isn't a mistake. Because we know so little. Here, what do we have on this international scene? Well, I want to say quite frankly, I have sympathized with whomever is president of the United States. He surely inherits a tough job. I knew that when I was seeking it, and I surely am not going to start out throwing rocks at a man who is president of the United States as he seeks to try to find some answers. I happen to believe that he's entitled to the time and the patience of the American people to work out a program, to feel his way, to get a steady sense of the hand on the helm to be able to direct this ship of state. I think that his trip to Europe was necessary, particularly if the ultimate objective is negotiations with the Soviet Union, because frankly the peace of the world does depend upon how we and the Soviet Union can get along and how we can work out our differences. We are the superpowers with great responsibility. The President of the United States has an incredibly difficult job. And I may feel at times as we go along as one of the people in public life or that has been in public life that maybe we should speak out because something that we do not agree with happens. But if I do, I'm going to offer an alternative. I have had a stomach full of carping criticism just for the sake of criticism. I've been in public life too long to want to indulge in that. I think it is important for those of us that disagree to have an alternative, a constructive alternative. So if you hear anything from me later on, it'll not be because I want to pick on somebody, but rather because I happen to think that something may be amiss, and I hope to be able to point out a better way, one man's point of view. Well, let's take a look at this world in which we live, quickly. I'm not going to spend time on Southeast Asia tonight because it's a highly complex and controversial area. I believe that the processes of peace are at least in their embryonic stage in Paris. I regret that there is this tragic recurrence or this resurgence of violence. I have a feeling that it is not going to last. I believe that the war in South Vietnam will slowly de-escalate. And I believe that as a result of that, in time, we're going to have a negotiated political settlement. That's about as simple and direct as I can put it to you. I wouldn't want you to think for a minute that it's going to be easy or in a hurry, because it's very difficult. But I hope that we do not that we don't fall to the temptation of precipitous acts that will destroy the possibility of a negotiated political settlement. This has been our objective, even though we have not always been able to get people to understand it. But now we have the chance, and we must be careful. Now what else? Berlin. Always there, a problem. But again, I happen to believe that the Soviet Union understands our power, and we surely understand hers, and they understand our commitment. So while it's dangerous, I don't consider it the most dangerous. I consider the most dangerous area of the world for you, for me, for Jew, Gentile, for Protestant, Catholic, black or white, the Middle East. And I have for years. And I know a little bit about it. I've tried to inform myself about that area as a senator and as a member of the National Security Council. Now let's just talk a little. Why is it dangerous? Well, first of all, there's in many areas lack of stable, sound political leadership. Secondly, many of the nations in the area have been heavily equipped with modern, sophisticated weapons. Without the political leadership, they can exercise the restraint in the use or the not using those weapons. But more importantly, because for the first time in a long time, the Soviet Union and the United States come head on. For 400 years, Russians, not communists, it didn't make any difference whether they're czars or commissars. They've been trying to get into the Mediterranean, out of the Black Sea, into the Mediterranean, into the Middle East, into North Africa. This has been a historical objective of czars and commissars. They're there. The Soviet fleet is there. So is ours, the Sixth Fleet. We have an alliance called the Grand Alliance, the NATO. We have the northern flank and the southern flank, the underbelly. The most dangerous part of Europe has always been southern Europe. What they used to call the Balkans, being the Aegean Sea, the southern flank. We're committed. Committed. Our men are committed. Our country is committed to the defense of all of the NATO area, which includes Turkey, which includes Greece, which includes Italy. And yet that area is in close geographical proximity to the powder keg of the world, the Middle East. And in the Middle East, we find what? Political regimes that are undemocratic, political leadership that comes and goes, that's highly emotional, that has no solid political base, no restraint, imposed either by law or custom. And we find the Soviet Union pouring arms by the hundreds of millions of dollars into the area. That's the picture. And we find a little country there called Israel. And by the way, anything I say about Israel tonight, I said 20 years ago. I was in Temple Israel, Minneapolis, Minnesota, with Rabbi Minda on the night of Israel's independence, and I was mayor of Minneapolis. I've been interested in Israel for many reasons. First of all, because I think it sets a good example for all that part of the world in government, in social progress, in what a nation state ought to be. It's opened up its doors to its refugees and to the refugees from many lands. And when we speak of refugees, and many people speak so much today of the Arab refugees, might I say that there have been Jewish refugees that came to Israel. They had to come from faraway places. And Israel found a place for them. And you helped, and others helped. Rather than to say that it was a political problem that would boil over into conflagration and war, something was done about it. And something can be done about refugees in any part of the world if there's a will to do it, unless you want to play politics with it. Well, I know that many of us here take great joy in reminding ourselves, as we did tonight, of the Six-Day War. Well, the Six-Day War was a great victory for Israel's armed forces, but it was only a victory for the moment. And let me tell you what I mean. I quit smoking, those cigars have got me, but that's all right. Let me tell you what I mean, the Six-Day War. I know that in 1967, this community, like every other community in America, rallied. When people came here, I'm sure they came, spokesmen came, said, "Help, Israel's in trouble. She needs your help." And there isn't a doubt in my mind that the better than 8,000 people in the Jewish community in this city, in this area, almost to a man and a woman, rallied to make some little help, and some of them very generous. I was at many of these meetings. I was in your government that time. I know what was going on in the government, and I know what was going on outside. I have some idea of what the facts were of the time. Well, it was nothing short of a military miracle what Israel was able to do. But ladies and gentlemen, don't always depend on miracles. Oh, there's a story they tell about those three great militarists that were down there in the fiery places talking about the amazing success of Israel's arms in the Six-Day War. Genghis Khan, you've maybe heard this one, you know, and Hannibal and Napoleon. And Genghis Khan, as these three militarists were visiting about the amazing achievement of Israel's armed forces, Genghis Khan said, "Oh, if I'd only had Israel's airplanes and their pilots, I'd have conquered the whole world." And Hannibal said, "What I'd have given for those Israeli tanks instead of those elephants, I would have been able to conquer Rome." Napoleon leaned back and said, "Well, fellas, all I'd wanted was Radio Cairo, and they'd never known I'd lost the Battle of Waterloo." Well, it's a good story. I like to tell it once in a while, and I got a big kick out of it because it kind of gives you a sense of euphoria. But the facts were stated from this podium tonight, either by Morris or Barney. My memory fails me for the moment. It was a six-day war and a victory, and there's a 365-day struggle on right now. And that's a fact. Now, your government, your country, my country, our country, helped the state of Israel. And I must tell you that within your government, whether it's a Democratic administration or a Republican administration, in the framework, in the bureaucratic structure of this government, which is a vital part of any government, there are contesting forces. Israel would have never been recognized as an independent nation state by the president of the United States of America had not Harry Truman overruled some of his advisors. And that's a fact. You know it. Whether it was Harry Truman or Dwight Eisenhower or John Kennedy or Lyndon Johnson, they have all had to have a firm hand on policy in the Middle East, or the policy of this country could well have been changed. And I speak as a member of the Senate for 16 years and 12 years, a member of the Foreign Relations Committee, and 8 of those 12 years, chairman of the Mideast Subcommittee, and a member of the National Security Council of this government. There are contesting forces within this government. They don't think they're anti, they just have a different point of view. And you've had to rely upon your elected political officials to take a stand. Does that tell you anything? I'm here to tell you, you better take an interest. And you better speak up, not just to yourself. One of the real problems that we have in meetings like this is we like to talk to each other. One of the reasons I come out here is because I am not of Jewish faith, and I can speak as a Gentile and as a Christian, and I can come here and speak about something that means everything to our country and means everything to every citizen of this country, so that we can help mold a public opinion. I'm not at all sure what an administration will do. I hope and pray that it will do what I think it's going to do, namely pursue a very constructive and helpful policy in the Middle East that will preserve and protect the independence and the sovereignty of Israel. But I'm not going to take any chances. I'm going to ask people to speak up and become involved. Just like you need to become involved with Louisville and its problems, you need to become involved with your government and its decisions, and you need to have some view of a kind of an international policy we ought to have. Now, many of you have been involved in Vietnam policy. Many of you have been involved in all kinds of policies, and you haven't hesitated to go to other meetings to speak your views about the war in Vietnam. I know. Well, now listen, be as brave. Don't be afraid. Don't think just because it's Israel and because you happen to attend a temple that this isn't vital to us. Of course it is. This doesn't make you less a good citizen. It makes you a better citizen. I happen to feel that there are elements of a just peace in the Middle East. I think that President Johnson outlined them in his letter of June 19, 1967. They're basic tenets that were looked upon by the responsible leadership in Israel as at least acceptable guidelines for a fair and equitable settlement in the Middle East. I want to be sure that those basic elements are not jettisoned in the name of peace and expediency. I am for the four-power conference. I'm for any kind of a conference that anybody can have that will lead to peace anywhere in the world. But I want to be sure that our government knows what it's doing when it goes there. I want to be sure that our spokesmen know what the guidelines are, know what the area of negotiation is, know how much we're willing to give and how far we're willing to go, and not to have a peace of expediency or one that is imposed, that is inequitable and unfair. I believe that's the important thing for you to understand. Now, we're going to have these conferences. Now, what are the elements then? Well, what's the problem? Well, first of all, the problem is that a number of nations in the world do not recognize the sovereignty of Israel. The first element of a just peace in the Middle East is a recognition of the independence and the freedom and the sovereignty of the state of Israel. That's number one. The second one is the end of the state of belligerency by its neighbors. You can't have peace without ending the state of belligerency, which is a legal fact today. If not a legal one, at least a fact. What's the third thing that needs to take place? That Israel, along with every other nation, our nation, Egypt, any other nation, shall have all the rights under international law to passage in international waterways, including the Suez Canal and the Gulf of Aqaba. This is absolutely essential. You think that we would settle for less? We've gone to war a half a dozen times over freedom of the seas. And it's important for a nation that's that small, that has so few areas where it can have freedom of movement, that it have freedom in the international waterways. What else is an element of that peace? That Israel shall have the means of her defense. A strategic balance is the only way in a world that is terrorized at times by brute force and that is the victim of propaganda and guerrilla warfare and tension. The only kind of peace, hope for peace that you have is out of what we call a strategic balance. Now, if Israel finds herself today with nobody to supply her with her means of defense and others to supply her enemies with all the means of attack, it poses a situation which is conducive to trouble. It would mean to Israel that maybe she would feel that she had to take preemptive measures before it was too late. Or if she sat back and said, I'll just defend myself or ourselves, she may be overwhelmed. Now, this government of yours, under Democrats and Republicans, has pledged that we would see to it that there were some modern, sophisticated, supersonic aircraft made available. Not many that they would buy. Called Phantom Jets. I want to say that my hope is that we could get an arms control agreement so that none of the nation states in the area would have to use their limited resources for the arms that are ultimately a waste. But until that can be, Israel must have the means of her defense or she will be the victim of attack or at least a threat. And the area of the Middle East, instead of becoming less tense, will become more tense. Instead of becoming less dangerous, will become more dangerous. And this affects the United States of America and every nation in Europe, in Asia, in Africa. These are some of the fundamentals. And then what else? We must work for the day that we can turn those deserts into fertile land through programs of resource development, taking the waters of the seas and making them sweet water so that the land becomes arable. That area of the world is potentially the richest area in the world. Its lands are waiting for the blessing of water, filled with the life of the sun, producing the capacity to produce untold foodstuff, an area rich in resources of people and the physical and natural resources of land and even water and minerals. It's there. And Israel is trying to show the way, my dear friends. This is what you must know and believe. It isn't just a matter of protecting another Jew, important as that is. And surely people of Jewish faith have right to be concerned about that in light of recent history. And you ought to be doubly concerned because we're mighty lucky in this country. But really what we're talking about is there is a country there that with its technicians, with its know-how, with its unusual human capacity, could be a godsend, a blessing to the entire area. And one of the great threats to peace in the world could be removed if for once and for all people could be brought together to join together in common enterprises. This is what your program is about. This is what the emergency fund is about. The emergency fund that you heard announced here tonight is about giving people the chance to live, not just to survive. A lot of difference. The emergency fund is another way for you to send a message throughout the world that you care and that somebody else cares. The government of France has closed off supplies. Other countries have put on, if not an official embargo, at least a de facto embargo. And Israel and her leaders, and she suffered tragedy again, losing her prime minister, going through the processes of an interim government, facing an election in November, with constant pressure upon her frontiers, with terrorism. Oh, I hear everybody talk about, you know, well, they shouldn't have done what they did at Beirut. Well, I was a little upset, to be frank about it. But then I say, well, what would you do? If we're all so smart, how do we deal with terrorism at home? What do you do? Terrorism. I've seen it in Vietnam. I've seen it in the Middle East. I've seen it in America. And we do not yet quite know what to do with this kind of guerrilla war, at home or abroad. And the Israelis are saying to the neighboring governments and the neighboring countries, you are harboring clandestine forces here. At least we think you are, and we ask you to take preventive measures so that those clandestine forces do not cross the frontiers, come in and blow up our villages, kill our children, destroy our waterworks. And nothing happens. Their airplanes are shot up. People are hanged in the name of being spies. Villages are destroyed. Children are shot down in the street. And a political and a government elected, not appointed, an elected government with a Knesset, a parliament, says, hey, you gonna let that happen to our people? And those elected officials have to respond. Now, if you've got a better answer for it, all of us that live in this nice, lovely, wonderful America, let's find it. We don't have a better answer for it right now. I don't like the answer that's being used, but we don't seem to have a better one. But I know this, that if Israel feels that she's isolated and forgotten, she will not act responsibly. Because she will be like a caged person that feels that there's no one left that cares. I come here to ask you for one thing only, to care. How much you care, that's up to you. I ask you to come here to let the whole world know that we care as people, and let your government know that we care. You have a right to. It's very peaceful. We're not demonstrating. We're not burning down anything. We just have a right to say we care. I'm coming here to tell you that by expressing through your good works that you care, you may do something more for your peace of the world than all the speeches that you've ever heard. And I submit that you can care, and it'll help you more than it helped those that you care for. So my challenge to you tonight is simply to do this. Whatever you thought you were going to do was never enough. You and I know that. Whatever you thought you could do is not enough. Israel never would have been if it was only what some people thought they could do. It's the difference between a great people and an ordinary people is doing the impossible. And the difference between a great nation and an ordinary nation is doing the impossible. I happen to think this little country of Israel, like our great country of America, has done the impossible. They have made representative government work. They've defended themselves. They've shown great courage in adversity. And with all of it, they haven't given up the hope of human betterment. Social progress, education, health, housing, everything that you and I believe that a democracy should be is still high on their agenda. And you're asked to help that. You're not asked to buy weapons. You're asked to help buy houses. You're asked to help buy some education. You're asked to help some people that want to come in find a place to live. You're else asked to give, well, you're privileged, may I say, privileged to have the opportunity to save a life, maybe to save a nation. And I know if we do right, to save peace. Thank you very, very much.